Thank you so much for your warm welcome and for coming out. I told Mike that I was a little encouraged that with so much work out there in the pro-life world, in my from my perspective of being an attorney, sometimes we think, well, it's all the lawyers, right? But it's not. It's so much more than that, and it really is a matter of thinking about culture and how we want to change hearts and minds, but also to be mindful of what do the laws say and how do we organize our affairs, how do we operate not-for-profits and go about our business of promoting life. I'm going to put this here and see if that'll work. Okay, good. And everybody can hear me? Okay. Yes, good. A little hard after lunch, right? Especially after the brownies. So good. It's just such a delight to be here. I've never come to a pro-life conference before, and it's just so exciting. I've done the March for Life Chicago a few years, which is, of course, a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And Lord willing, I'll be at the March for Life in D.C. next year, hopefully with some or all of you. Clicker here. So I love life, and as you all do, and I think my big introduction to the pro-life world was really through the Thomas More Society, which is a wonderful public interest law firm that helps so many organizations, whether it's in litigation or starting to get their organizations up and running or keeping them out of trouble, all kinds of things. And so that's really been my world, and particularly through my work with pro-life organizations, thinking about what does it mean to intersect with politics. So just maybe take a little poll. How many of you all are involved with a nonprofit organization? Okay, great. That's why you're here. You're like, oh, yeah, I get to ask my questions on. Okay, and how many of you all have been involved in politics as well, either individually or through your organization? Okay, and how many of you have, like, some burning question you hope to get answered today? Okay, or just generally learn. Okay, good. Okay, so what I want to do is go through the kind of the do's, don'ts, and it depends, and really thinking about three areas. One is, well, what kind of organization are we talking about here? A 501c3, a C4, or a PAC, or 527. And then secondly, some people get really excited about political campaign questions and how much can I do or how much can I push the limits and those kinds of things. So we'll talk about that as well. This is not so much a burning issue. Usually when it's the presidential election year, that's when I get lots and lots of phone calls. And I'm happy to deal with those. There are a lot of tricky areas. And then the last section I really want to focus on is educational issue advocacy, which I think is a huge, huge area. And that's really kind of the quintessential hearts and minds. I think that's been such, you know, if you were in the session, the lunch session, just to really think about kind of those bigger questions that we're talking about morality itself, not just the abortion issue, not just, you know, who should we have elected or what laws should get passed, but who are we in our core cultural context, okay? So we'll get underway with that. All right. So one question is, well, why even get involved in politics? When you got involved with pro-life, I mean, did you think, oh, well, pro-life equals politics? Or pro-life is apart from politics? I mean, why is this an issue at all? Well, when we talk about abortion within the U.S. system, we're really talking about grave questions of public policy and how should things be done. And with respect to so many other areas as well as abortion, really our trend is that everything's getting politicized. If you hear the expression, you know, there ought to be a law, right? It was really interesting to hear how, you know, that it, because of Christianity, that, you know, there were laws that made it illegal, and now it's legal, and so now we want to get it illegal again. So there's this intersection with politics, not necessarily so, but because this has become a politicized issue. So because of that, we say, okay, well, as we get involved in some sort of concerted way, what kind of nonprofit should we have to do some work with that intersection of politics? And then what kind of activity may we do or not do? So we'll talk about that, and this focus on educational issue advocacy is changing hearts and minds. Okay, so everybody loves the IRS, right? Before I get to that, okay, just to mention, too, there are handouts in the back. I have three if you want to pick those up on your way in or the way out. I just want to make sure everybody has a chance to the PowerPoint itself. I have issue advocacy guidelines with the political campaign Q&A that I find very helpful. A lot of my clients have that, and that seems to help them. And then I have an article I wrote called Speak Up on Issue Advocacy that I wrote a few years ago. It's a little bit dated because that was kind of in the wake of the IRS scandal. And so there was some, the IRS was trying to make some changes and it kind of didn't come to pass, but it's still very relevant as far as how these issues get addressed. And I have my card back there as well. Anybody, you're welcome to take my card. We have a newsletter. You're welcome to email me and say, could you please put me on your monthly newsletter? One of our big firm values is to educate our clients about all kinds of things of interest in the nonprofit world. Okay, so on to the IRS. So the bad news is the IRS is in charge of this area of how political can we get? Can we be in a political campaign? How much lobbying can we do? Where do we bump up against the lines of things we shouldn't be involved with? But the good news is, generally speaking, there are some very clear areas, and we can talk about that, as well as the fact that the IRS has kind of gone to sleep in a lot of ways. And so I think that it's a tricky thing for a lot of organizations, because if you're very much a rule follower and you say, well, I really want to know exactly what I can do and what I can't do, in some areas that's clear, in some areas it's not. And so when do you push the limits, when do you not? I do think the pro-life movement, anecdotally speaking, is very good at pushing the limits, and there's some moral elements to that. So, you know, that stands on its own, but sometimes, you know, I get the call, well, so-and-so did it, and there was some bishop who did something that none of the rest of us should do. Like, okay, well, you know, like, you're before the Lord, and before the Lord, is that okay? And then otherwise, okay, you're on a board of a nonprofit organization. Do you really want to tango with the IRS or not, and what are the chances? So there's some pragmatic considerations involved with that as well. Okay. Big picture. You guys know where this is from, right? Okay, so it's the First Amendment, and we're really fundamentally talking about freedom of speech. And so kind of a fundamental question is, do nonprofits even have a right of free speech? Do they? Yeah. Okay, absolutely. That's right. One of my early intersections with Thomas More Society, which I was so privileged, just of such a blessing in the long run, right? Because these are all, you know, you fight these battles and then you realize later, Lord, that was for my good, or that brought, you know, this trauma brought out some amazing testimony from that. And so I represented this sweet woman who had like this puny organization, I mean, by any stretch, maybe $5,000 in revenues, and they prayed outside of Planned Parenthood. And so they applied to the IRS in 2009 to get their 501c3, and sure enough, the IRS agent, you know, everybody's, you know, we're all human, and I don't think this IRS agent likes them. So she wrote back and she said, you can have your 501c3 status as long as you promise not to protest or picket outside of Planned Parenthood. Yeah. Okay, so here's this organization and here's Planned Parenthood, right? Okay, and there's like this little mosquito on the elephant. But prayer is powerful, right? Because somehow there was this, you know, it's understood this is a threat to Planned Parenthood and to the orientation of this IRS agent who didn't like it. So she said, as long as your board members promise not to protest or picket, you can have your 501c3 status. So then they called Thomas More Society, then I got involved, wrote a little letter saying, oh no, the not-for-profit, including their individual directors, they all have First Amendment rights of free speech. And we got that application approved within a week. And she got a little religion and it all worked out. And then fast forward 4 years later, she went to testify before Congress with Tom Brecka from TMS, and I had the privilege to participate in the writing of that testimony. But it was really amazing to see this very modest woman stand up, you know, kind of to the machine. So that's the freedom of speech. Okay, so this is some kind of basics. I don't know how familiar you all are with this or not, so I want to kind of lay the groundwork. So we have our 501c3, and that's kind of that special privileged organization, because there are many kinds of 501c organizations. The 501c3 is really the only one, basically speaking, the only one that you can get tax-deductible contributions. So that's where you want to be, right, in order to get the maximum dollars, because people love to donate. Generally speaking, they prefer to donate to a C3 so they can get the tax deduction as opposed to C4 or a C527. Okay, but then there's like, it comes at a price tag. So the 501c3, there's a bright line test that says you cannot get involved with any political campaign activity. Do people violate that? Yeah, okay. And there's a special case, what's that? You know, that's actually very interesting. Let me back up for just a minute. Churches do this all the time. Churches are 501c3s. They're basically, as long as they're organized and operated as churches, they are 501c3s. They don't need a letter, although sometimes they get it. But they'll push the limits, and there's some special rules in place that are still kind of percolating about how churches have to be treated by the IRS because of the First Amendment. But the rule is no political campaign activity, and only insubstantial lobbying. We'll talk about that a little bit more. A C4, they can do limitless lobbying, and the Citizens United case, years back, it was really kind of opened the door to what some people call dark money. So there's a lot of lobbying going on within the C4 space. I represent a fair number of organizations that have a C4 kind of in their hip pocket. And I think it's a really good thing to do because, not for everybody, but if you have a C3, then you can say, okay, here's all our educational stuff. Here's our outreach. Oh, I don't have my, if you guys have your brochure, I just love this. I told Molly, I said, you did this just for my talk. Because we're talking about prayer and education is really where your C3 space is. Action is a kind of a catchphrase for doing the lobbying, and that's kind of C4 space. And voting, it can bleed over to the other ones, but fundamentally, if you're saying who to vote for, that's going to be somewhat in the C4 space, as long as it's not 50% or more. But that is what a PAC or 527 must do, because that's what they're charged with. They cannot do the other stuff. They have to do political campaign activity. So back to your point, Planned Parenthood, it still just burns me up. You know, you think back to the Democratic National Convention, and there's Cecile Richards in the Clintons' box, right? How dare she be there? And they're waving, and it's great. And like, wait a minute. C3s can't do political. How could she be there? You know, this doesn't make, not Cecile Richards individually, which is one way you could do it, but Cecile Richards of Planned Parenthood up there endorsing a political campaign candidate. And so I think generally speaking, I wouldn't recommend that folks do that like so brazenly because Planned Parenthood is a beast. But the legal way that arguably they get around that is they have their C4. And so I assume that Planned Parenthood was there as a C4, not as a C3. Now, whether the general public noticed that difference, that's another question, right? So that's kind of, it's a little slippery. That's what I was. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, actually, when it comes to organized. Okay, so it's a great, this is so fun. I've done this talk multiple times. This is the first time. I always kind of tread around it, but I'll say, oh, you know, whether you're into environmentalism or, you know, other whatever issues or pro-life. But this is when I got to do just pro-life. So what I want to point out with this is that they're kind of an existential question for everybody is how do you best accomplish your mission? Okay, so if you're a crisis pregnancy center, it's with compassion and love to reach out to the women and the families who are involved in that stage of their lives. And so maybe you don't want to do political campaign activity, or maybe you don't want to do lobbying, or maybe you do, or other organizations who do a lot of educational outreach, and they say, okay, well, that's fine, but now there's a bill. And now we want to get behind that. And what's kind of interesting in that arena with social media today, it's relatively cheap to go tweet things. And the IRS tends to look at lobbying in terms of dollars spent. So the dollars spent could be on staff, but it's not like the olden days where you have to buy a lot of hard copy kind of stuff. So you can do lobbying fairly cheap, and that leads to some other questions that I'll come back to. But, you know, so this is question. So how do you want to accomplish the mission of the day, which is to change the culture, really? And do you want to do it by marching? Yeah. Okay, yes, right? Do you want to do it by educating people? Yes, like through science and that kind of thing. Do you want to do it by changing the laws? Yes. And you want to change by electing pro-life candidates. I mean, I'm sure we're all so thankful in the room that, you know, the Supreme Court has now got, you know, a different flavor, and hopefully will continue that trend because of the election of President Trump, whether you agree with other things about him or not. So get out there, you know, be visible, but we want to think about these different lanes of what you can do. Okay, so which really raises that question of how do you best accomplish that kind of mission. Does anybody want to volunteer what they think educational issue advocacy is? I've probably said it 10 times already. We're a smaller crowd, so we can popcorn a little bit. Or you can just sit there and receive. That's okay. Generally speaking, it's just educating people about matters of public concern. So if you want to go out into the schools and talk about conception, and Wednesday, I'll give my little shout out. Wednesday, I went to a wonderful lunch session sponsored by Christian Legal Society in my hometown, Chicago, with Rita Gitchell. Anybody know Rita? Just, yeah, I know. Thanks to Thomas More Society, she came. And so she talked all about embryology. And at the end of the meeting, all these lawyers were saying, we need to support pro-life. That was educational issue advocacy. Like, I can't believe this. This is like slavery, where we're saying humans are less than human, right? That's educational issue advocacy. There was no discussion of voting or laws, other than in the context of this is what the law is or this is what was passed, okay? And then political campaign activity, okay, well, yeah, we know what that is, but do we? Because you say, all right, well, is it just saying I'm for a candidate or I'm against a candidate? What if you're for a party? What if you have a voter guide that's, you know, generally Republican, because that's what we are? And I love it when we get other candidates, because then you don't have to say, are you, you know, partisan? I love the flavor of this whole conference. We're not going to get into the partisanship that's so easy to fall into. But that is one area. And so where does that bleed over when we start talking? If we only invited Republican candidates to some sort of pro-life forum, is that getting into political campaign activity? And probably the most acute reflection of political campaign activity is usually right before an election, where everything's winnowed down to one candidate or another. So, like, for example, in my sad state of Illinois, I don't know if you've heard about Bruce Rauner and his great betrayal, that he voted against pro-life causes, probably to please his wife. And so now there's a woman named Jeannie Ives running. And I'm not saying anything about endorsing one way or the other, but if you say vote Republican, it doesn't necessarily communicate whether you're voting, you know, or you're advocating in a political campaign. Now, once one of them wins out over the other, if you say vote Republican, that could be taken as some sort of political campaign involvement. So it gets a little squishy, and we'll talk a little bit later about functional equivalence. Okay, and then lobbying. Anybody, lobbying, what's lobbying? Okay, thank you. Okay, so voting a legislator to say please vote a certain way, one way or the other. So that's direct lobbying. And then there's grassroots lobbying, which is what a lot of you guys do. Call your senator, call your congressman, tell them we won't stand for this. Please vote against this or that, or vote for right of conscience. That's a grassroots lobbying. And it's treated a little bit differently, but basically that's all connected with lobbying. Okay? All right. So which direction do you take? Have you guys grappled with that in your organizations? Should we do more? Should we do less? Should we start a PAC? Should we have a C4? Does that make sense to you guys? Maybe you'll think about it after this. So you said, yeah, you're, what are you doing? You're doing all three. How's that going?
Education, no problem there.
Okay, education, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you do public policy. What do you mean by public policy done through the C4?
Lobbying.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, could people take those different terms? I would think of public policy as C3 type activities as far as education and influence. You're probably thinking public policy as in talking to the legislators and getting out and affecting the laws. Okay. Yeah, and I think that's great. Some people, you know, do only one. It gets a little complicated when you do more than one organization. You need to have boards. You need to have different levels of reporting. You need to be really careful about staying in your lane, because a 501c3 has charitable assets, and those may not be used for some other organization. And so, in other words, you can be as generous as you want to the C3, but the C3 cannot just give out its resources to ever, particularly to advance a PAC or a C4. And my caveat to that would be, unless you're, and I say the colloquial, and I have a little bit of Dutch in me, so I'm allowed to say this, right? Unless you're going Dutch. So if you and I go out to dinner and I get my credit card out and you say, okay, I'll pay you back later, that's fine. And that's basically how a C3 and a C4 can operate in a clean way to, you know, normally I would put together some sort of agreement that says this is what you pay, this is what we pay, and we'll split it up. And generally speaking, if we're going to err on either side, we're going to err on the C4 being generous to the C3. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, good, good. And then,
When you're talking about the C3, you mentioned churches. Can you clarify maybe a little bit about the Johnson Amendment?
Yeah, you all are the Johnson Amendment. Everybody know what the Johnson Amendment is? It's funny. I think 5 years ago, I don't know anybody that knew what it was. So funny you should ask. If you go on our website, which is just my name, Wagonmaker and Law, wagonmakerlaw.com, we just posted something. There was a letter that was written by several organizations like the atheist, whatever, and the super liberal church and the interesting organizations that banded together. But basically what they said was, we need the Johnson Amendment to protect churches from running amok. And if they're allowed to get involved in politics, they'll just fall apart. I don't think so. That's really the article. So the Johnson Amendment, basically, by Revolutionary War era, people were in churches preaching about the Revolutionary War. Slavery era, people were preaching about, politically speaking generally, not just political campaigns, okay? So I understand when Lyndon Johnson was in the House of Representatives, he got upset about somebody politicking out of a 501c3, and so he helped get this law passed to say there is a bright line test that 501c3s may not get involved with political campaigns on pain of death, on pain of tax revocation. It's not like lobbying where, like, you can file a 501h election as a c3, and if you pass the line financially, generally speaking, you'll get whacked, you'll get attacked. You have to be a little careful about that, because as a 501c3, you cannot be engaged substantially in something that's not 501c3 type activities. So with the Johnson Amendment, basically they passed this bar, and then people violate it left and right. So now there's a lot of falderal about, well, should we get rid of it? Should we not? Churches should do it anyway. I mean, it's a fascinating kind of metaphysical discussion, because churches are basically automatically 501c3. So you get revoked, you spring right back the next day. And then with the IRS, the law on the books right now is that only a certain high-level IRS official may institute a church exam, and that high-level official is designated by a job title that does not exist anymore at the IRS. And that's why, as a practical matter, you can't get investigated by the IRS. So the quick fix is to just change the job description, change the law to match, because like it used to be geographical and now it's like by type of division. So they could just change the law, except that people are so upset about it. So it's back and forth. Yes.
I understood somebody told me that the Johnson Amendment applies only to candidates, but the issue is the minister of the church could preach it.
Well, that's why when I'm talking about these lanes and the type of activity, so the question is that it applies only, that the Johnson Amendment, the prohibition, political campaign prohibition, applies only to candidates and not to issues that somebody could preach about or talk about in a church. And that's why it's so important to think about these moral issues. And that's not right, because political campaign involvement, I'm jumping way ahead, but basically it's, I can fast forward, or I can, let's see. So here we go. What constitutes, this is your question, what can they do? So can a pastor say, my pastor gave this amazing sermon about a year and a half ago on politics, and we're all like, right before the election, okay, who are you going to say to vote for? And what he did was he said, okay, here's the 7 irreducibles, okay, and one of them was life and family and the environment and care for the poor. And then he had a stack of books here and a stack of books here. And he said, people I respect and care for, they wrote these books. People I respect and care for, they wrote those books. So here's the irreducibles. People come out different. He wouldn't tell us who to vote for. It was so frustrating. So he spoke to the moral issues. But he did not advocate. He did not endorse a candidate. He did not talk about parties. Because if you say, don't vote, like in the past presidential election, if you said, don't vote for a Republican, don't vote for a Republican, vote for a Democrat. Well, thankfully there was Bernie and Hillary. So that in itself, you can't really tell. But once it was just Hillary, then it's like, oh, well, if you say vote against, you know who you're voting. If you said vote against the Republicans, well, it was a whole bunch of them until it got consolidated. If you want to talk about positions, vote pro-life. I mean, I think that's a great thing to say. But the IRS looks at things in terms of context, and so how close are you to the election? If you're super close to the election and you say vote pro-life, if it's going to be Jeannie Ives against the Democrat in Illinois and you say vote pro-life, oh, absolutely, that's advocating for Jeannie Ives. So are you talking about candidates? Are you making facilities available for a election debate? So if you only invite certain candidates, or now you're advocating against. So it gets a little slippery. And voter guides are really a challenge, I would say, in the broad scheme of things, like bar associations. Bar associations publish voter guides, and they're like, here's all these people, and here's where they stand, the end. Pro-life organizations do it a little bit differently, and therefore I generally counsel them to do it through their C4. Because generally speaking, I mean, depending on how many candidates there are, it's going to be a single issue kind of thing. Here's your vote, pro-life candidates, go vote. I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to work. Catholic Vote or Catholic Citizens, they'll do get out the vote drive. And that's really good. They're like, get out the vote. And that's why the talks like you've been hearing today are so important, because you say, okay, so let's school up on what it means to be a human, what it means to be in the womb, and then go vote. How's that going to work? Okay, that's C3 kind of activity. Does that make sense? Right. So talking about Republican platforms and planks. So I think so two really important points on that. One is, I think it's perfectly appropriate to talk about a Republican plank or a platform, or, you know, the Democratic platform is officially, you know, abortion on demand until, you know, the very end. It's a little dangerous because people are going to think you're about to talk about a political campaign. and I think there's a lot of wisdom in it, depending on how you want to go about things. I think of one client I have in particular that tries so hard to go over politics and to talk about humanity and to talk about the moral issues of our day. And one of the reasons they do that is very astute, not to dodge politics, but to say, you know what, we live in a very polarized environment. And so let's not get into these camps. Let's not make it binary, but let's go over. And that's why I'm such a huge fan of educational issue advocacy, because then you're not alienating people. It's what is the politics, I'm not a politician, but the politics of inclusion. So let you know, like I have a friend who said, you know, I've been a lifelong Democrat. I think of Democrats as the party of compassion. And so we talked about pro-life, and he is thinking so hard about that. So, so hard. So, yeah.
The problem is, you talk about the church.
Mm-hmm. The church, yeah.
The issue of abortion is not a political issue.
Exactly, right?
This is a moral issue.
It's not a political issue, yes. To speak on abortion, but not necessarily to say who to vote for. And if that pastor feels so compelled to say who to vote for, like I said, he stands before the Lord.
For example, if you vote for somebody, mm-hmm. you're going to vote for having the baby killed.
Yes,
I'm not saying, when you vote for a candidate whose objective is going to protect.
Right.
Roe versus Wade, and have the baby killed right after the baby.
Right. So you're saying that a church leader should, as a moral issue, speak in favor of a candidate who would be against abortion because abortion is such a moral evil?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but two candidates, one wants to build the bridge, and the other wants to build a tower at the airport. They have two different issues. They're not moral issues.
Yeah.
Where do we want to put the
right.
Line?
Right. Right. Yeah, right.
But when you're talking about life and death,
yes. It's so critical.
Dedicated to life and death.
Right. Well, that's why there's this conference, I think, and that's why it's so sorely needed. And this is why every single person in this room is so sorely needed, because we need to be pushing towards that. And I can't tell you, you know, in this talk, officially as an attorney, being recorded on YouTube, go out there and flaunt the law. Do I think the Johnson Amendment is unconstitutional? Yes. Am I in favor of repealing it? You know, honestly, I'm not sure, because I think it is such a quagmire of people going back and forth. And I would rather have people focus on changing hearts and minds than getting involved and kind of, you know, sometimes you've got to be really careful, because if you push an issue, what's going to happen. And as a practical matter, if somebody says in church, vote for somebody because they're pro-life, the IRS is not going to come after them tomorrow. They're just not. So that's why it's an issue before that pastor and the Lord. And, you know, the pastor, anybody can speak in a personal capacity. So the pastor can say, well, I'm going to a pro-life rally. And now you know where the pastor stands on that. There's so much to your questions. So I need to move on. But I think they're very well taken. And you all hear what I'm saying? I'm talking about the law. And then there's the law, there's the ways, okay, well, then I'll do it through a PAC, or I'll do it, a C4 can do political campaign activity, or I'm going to do it anyway and see what happens. And that is what some people do. So I enjoyed reading Joe Scheidler just published a new book. I don't know if any of you read it. It's so fascinating. He talks about going in a C3 capacity to go protest Bill Clinton. I did not write him a letter to tell him about that. You know, he's a hero. Right. Okay. So we're back to the IRS here. So I'm going to talk. We've kind of jumped in this. You guys are your great audience, and I think your questions in particular. I'm sorry, your name.
Leo.
Okay. Are very helpful. You've moved us along here. Okay. So I've already talked about this when there were a whole bunch of candidates. So you know, get lots of candidates because it makes it easier to talk about pro-life. Frankly, you know, when there were tons of Republican candidates, it was just beautiful. Like vote pro-life. Whatever you do in this case, you know, it didn't mean a thing. And like I said, thank God for Bernie Sanders, at least in that one capacity. Okay. So I just went over that slide. Okay. And I was just commenting on your personal time. So it's something to really think about. Like if you want to say, like, write an op-ed. God bless you. Get out there. Get the word out. But you're probably going to write an op-ed in your personal capacity or on behalf of your C4 or something like that. There's lots of things that go on with that. I've gotten many calls over the years about, you know, well, can we do this or can we do that? So get to the front of the parade, but not on behalf of a C3, especially like if you take something out in the newspaper. I mean, what an easy target to be in the newspaper and then to get in trouble that way. Okay. Websites and links. So I kind of come with you with a question about the Planned Parenthood. I just love this slide. I had a totally different one for my non-pro-life crowd. are you guys familiar with the SBA list and Charlotte Lozier? Okay. So Charlotte Lozier Institute is a C3. SBA list is a C4. Now, a lot of organizations, I was trying to find a good example because years ago, I used to have a Planned Parenthood slide up here simply because you can toggle back and forth between Planned Parenthood Action and Planned Parenthood. It's very confusing, and intentionally so. Okay? So the rule from the IRS is if you're going to go from one to the other, like you're really trying to get people in, which is fine, you know, and you're trying to get them to donate money, you're trying to get them involved, then you can toggle back and forth, but you should at least have a pop-up that says you are now leaving C3 land, you are now leaving C4 land, okay? So that's what the IRS says is a really important thing to do with this link. And so I tried to find different organizations. Nobody has that anymore, you know, like not even Planned Parenthood. You have to go to this website or that one. And SBA, and that's probably a better practice, like Charlotte Lozier and SBA list. You really have to go. That's why I had to do a split screenshot. I found one organization that's pro-life. I thought, oh, well, they'll have that pop-up. They have no pop-up. They're actually in violation, so we'll talk to them later. so I thought, well, I'm not putting them up as the bad example. So this is my assistant. I don't know this show. but this is from Parks and Rec, I guess, or something. I don't know. What was it? Molly Smith said, I have no jokes. You know, that's kind of me too. So this is about as funny as I get. And so the point here is, can you invite a candidate to come to your event, even to speak? We have political candidates here. They're not speaking. If they were speaking, that would be fine. My Christian Legal Society years ago, we had Ben Carson come. He committed before he came a candidate. It was so exciting. And so what we did before he came was we talked about, so what are we going to do with a political candidate? Okay. And so why is that person coming? We had Ben Carson come because he was such a wonderful promoter of religious liberty. And then, okay, you're only going to speak as a non-candidate, which he definitely pushed limits, but we survived. and some other restrictions there. I don't know if you could read them here. We're not going to talk about the candidacy. We're not going to have campaign activity. There was some Barack Obama when he first ran. There's all kinds of stuff going on. He spoke at the United Church of Christ conference, and there was a lawsuit about that. We want to have a nonpartisan tone. And again, if you go over partisanship. It's better for your organization. It's better for legal. Okay? And you put this in writing. You send a letter. This is why I put this on the side. Please take a handout if you're interested. Because you send a letter. And you say, we're so excited. Thank you for coming because of whatever you've done as a humanitarian, as a leader. Please note the following. Okay? All right. Now we're back to educational issue advocacy. This is what I want to kind of focus on our last. We have 10 minutes. And then we'll, okay. So, oops. Okay, this is fun. Dan Miller's here. Okay. So one of my favorite cases of all times is Wisconsin Right to Life. Does anybody know that case? It came before the Supreme Court about electioneering, okay? And some of the guiding principles from that case, or really before that, are just these two quotes. One was from Massachusetts, Citizen for Life. Freedom of speech plays a fundamental role in our democracy. It is freedom of thought and speech is the matrix, the indispensable condition for every form of freedom. It's an essential mechanism of democracy to hold people accountable. So it's just so important. And the pro-life folks have done so much to promote freedom of speech. We can all be thankful for that. Okay, so I've been talking about some of these different terms, and issue advocacy is this educational thing. It can be also can be like your research. If you say, you know, you publish your scientific information, or if somebody from Congress wants you to come and testify, you go. That is not lobbying. That's all in the nature of issue advocacy. Express advocacy is when you say vote for or against something like this. And then the Supreme Court, what they really had to grapple with is this magic words. And so if I wink at you the night before of an election between, you know, two candidates, between Trump and Clinton, if I said vote pro-life, you know exactly what I mean, don't you? Right? That's the functional equivalent, okay? And so the Supreme Court said, well, we're not fools. We know the difference, okay? So here's a little bit more. Issue advocacy, we're basically educational. Well, and then the IRS says, okay, you can be educational. You're training people. And in the olden days, one of the problems with some of the cases we had was the IRS had this goofy test that was called the full and fair exposition test, which is basically you have to tell both sides. So if you have a slogan that says smoking kills, you have to say, well, maybe it's not so bad after all. Isn't that weird? They were you have to kind of, there's no conscience kind of thing. It's like you have to promote kind of equal opportunity. And so that doesn't really work so well. Okay. Oh, and I guess my other point with education, well, isn't everything educational? I mean, not the ads that are currently running in Illinois. But you know, if you say, well, so-and-so is not pro-life. That's educational, isn't it? And this bill is going to really harm babies. That's educational. But these are kind of terms of art, okay? So when we say educational issue advocacy, it's without regard to or aside from the political overlay, the politicization, which is kind of a rabbit hole. So in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, the Supreme Court said freedom of speech is so important that if there's a tie, the tie goes to the speaker, not to the censor. Okay, and we're only going to curtail speech only as much as necessary. So in legalese, what that basically translates to is strict scrutiny. And the Wisconsin Right to Life case, it was actually about a C4, and a C4 was running ads right before an election, like 30 days before, and they were running it on a legislative issue, but it involved the candidates. And so the question was, is this campaign activity, or is it legislative lobbying, and the law that was involved actually had criminal penalties. So it was quite serious. And in some ways, that's been a distinguishing mark. It's like, this is not a criminal issue for nonprofits or for C3s. It's more of a, well, I get revoked, which is actually quite serious, right? And so they said, let's be really, really careful about this. And the tie goes to the speaker, not the censor. And that's my article that's in the back, okay? So these are kind of some, so is this a crime? Strict scrutiny, so the government needs to be at least invasive as possible. And in particular, the court said, we are not going to do any of these kind of contextual, squishy, intent-based. What did they really mean when they did this close in time? Like, I don't know if you've ever done this with your organization, but, you know, right before an election or right before a law is up, you want to educate people about how important pro-life is. That's a little squishy, okay? It's because it's right before something that's more political. But what if you did it all the time? What if you did it all year long? Well, that's way better. It's better for your advocacy. It's better for legal compliance. And in fact, in response to some of these issues, the IRS tried to have this bright line test, and they said, okay, so 30 days, this is about 4 years ago, 30 days before an election, you can't do X, Y, and Z. Well, guess what? Primaries are like this month and then that month. So basically the effect would have been a blackout. We can't talk about this stuff. We're going to be squat. And that's to your point, sir, that, you know, at that point you're muzzled, and then what do? You have some civil disobedience. So thankfully the IRS proposal got shot down. And so this is kind of what the case looked at. Is it functional equivalent? Let's look at objective factors. Context is supposed to be irrelevant, okay? And you need to have a compelling government interest to shut down that kind of speech. We're not going to have bright lines. And if you have your handout, you can read these quotes, which I think are very important and helpful. So guess what? About a week before the Wisconsin Right to Life decision came down, the IRS issued this revenue ruling. And some of you may be familiar with this, but guess what? Essentially what they did is they said, let's do squishy. Let's do context. Let's do facts and circumstances. So let's look at the timing. Let's look at the intent. Are they referring to a voting election? Is it a distinguishing issue for candidates? What's the schedule look like? So it's completely contrary to what the Supreme Court had ruled a week later. Did the IRS fix themselves? No. Which is really tragic, and that's my article, basically, is that we are operating in an unconstitutional scheme. What does that mean for you all? It means that you're operating in a lot of gray areas. It's, you know, you have to be careful. I would say be very judicious. So in other words, to say, okay, I'll just be really conservative, or I'm going to be out there. And I think to some of the points that was raised, what if one time we want to push the limits and go beyond? Is the world going to fall apart? None of this is self-executing. There are some questions on the 990 about lobbying and how much you spend on it, and should you have a 501H election, which is basically to say, to raise your hand and say, I'm going to do a fair amount of lobbying. Oh, and I'm willing to report a whole bunch about it, too. So I'm a little hesitant on 501H elections unless you just got a really strong plan, like you know you're going to hire a lobbyist, it's going to be X part of your budget and that kind of thing. I just want to close with this. So imagine the impact of what you're doing. And that's what I think you all have really been doing all throughout this conference and will continue to do tomorrow. I just want to encourage you, whatever you do, to imagine that impact and then to be very strategic about how you do it. And I want to close with a little scripture and then open it up for questions. And I'm happy to stick around a little bit. From Jeremiah 1:5, the word of the Lord came and said, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. And then down to verse 17. So get ready. Stand up and say to them whatever I command to you. Don't be terrified by them. Today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, the kings, officials, priests, people of the land. They will fight against you, but will not overcome you. For I am with you, and I will rescue you, declares the Lord. So I hope that's an encouragement. It's a wonderful privilege to be before you all. Glad to take some questions.
I have questions on these index cards, Sally. So our first question is, clarify what you mean by churches are automatically 501c3s. If a church doesn't incorporate under a state's jurisdiction and doesn't apply to be treated as a 501c3, then how does a church automatically get the 501c3 status as opposed to non-taxable IRS section 170c?
Wow, what a great question. Can I just hang on? Sure. That's great. Okay. So that's a very careful question. So and my law partner actually corrected me, because I say all the time, churches are automatically 501c3s. He said, no, they're presumed to be 501c3. And if you look in the tax code 508, section 508 says basically as long as you're organized and operated as a church, this is really a First Amendment issue, okay? So long as you're organized and operated as a church, then you do not have to affirmatively seek IRS approval. So basically, in a nutshell, you are automatic, but you better be operated like a church. Like if you're just, hanging out at the beach, you're not automatic. Then you call yourself a church. You're not. You have to actually walk the walk, right? So, you don't have to apply to the IRS. But then if you say you want to apply for who knows what, and they say, where's your IRS letter? Well, you don't have one because it's like the air we breathe. It's full of oxygen. You don't need me to declare that to you. If you need an R1 visa, You absolutely have to have an IRS determination letter because the same government that says we follow the tax code says you need an IRS determination letter. So sometimes people like to have it just in case, or they feel better about it. It makes it clear, especially if you're kind of an unusual church, if you're like a coffee shop or something like that, it makes it clear the IRS has blessed you, but you don't need their blessing. The other thing I would say is, the other part of this question is, just keep in mind that you're under state law and you're under federal law. So for state law, the question is kind of a risk management thing is, do you incorporate? Okay. Some people think, oh, we shouldn't incorporate. We don't want the government to know about us. That's kind of a matter of preference. If you don't incorporate, then here's the church. Here's the steeple. Open the doors. All these people can be liable. Okay. If you say, here's the church, here's the steeple, and we're incorporated, well, then you're protected and you're an entity under state law. Either way, not necessarily. Either way. If you have an EIN, you are a taxable entity and you owe some kind of tax return. So if you don't, like if you're not a church, and you don't affirmatively seek 501c3 status, you're going to owe a tax return. And the default would be an 1120, which is for a taxable corporation. So a church should, generally speaking, usually incorporates, and they're generally viewed as automatically tax exempt as long as they're a bona fide church. And they can get their C3 letter if they'd like. Okay, and then Section 170 is about donations. So that's the corollary for the donee is the church, Section 501c3. The donor is under 5170. Can you take a charitable deduction under 170? Okay.
We have four more questions, and one has been answered already, I think, or at least it's been answered more than the others have. So next question will be, pro-life voter cards, if they are given out by a church, does the church need to be a C4 or just the group putting the card out to the churches?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you're saying like voter cards, like go register, that's fine. That's a civic kind of thing. If you're saying here's who to vote for, who is pro-life, really both organizations need to check themselves because the organization that puts it out probably should be a C4 unless it's very broad. You know, unless it were like, here's a voter guide on the 16 Republican candidates in 2016 and where they stand. That might be, but again, there were several pro-life candidates. So you could say, you know, these five are pro-life, these however many they were are not pro-life, I can't remember. Or they're all pro-life, so vote for one of them, but that's a little meaningless. So if you're putting the card out, as a practical matter, like I said, a C3 that's not a church is going to file a 990, has got to say, there's a question, have you engaged in political activity? If you have integrity, what are you going to do? You say no? You say yes? And if you're a non-church, you're going to be subject to audit. That's a red flag. If you're a church, you do not file 990s. And so you're not going to have to self-report, which is a wonderful thing. God bless America for the First Amendment. So, again, those are the questions before you and the Lord as a church. So I'd say a C3 that puts a voter guide in better be non-issue oriented as far as telling people who to vote for or against. A church that puts it in is going to be under the radar more, I guess I would say that way.
The next two questions are pretty technical to a non-lawyer. Could you touch on the distinction between state and federal laws? A good example of this is that your IRS tax status does not clear you of following state lobbying declaration registration laws. Likewise with local PAC filing laws. For most people here, state lobbying laws will apply before federal.
Yeah, that's a complicated question. Thank you. So kind of just referring back to that whole, you know, you form under state law and then you have a federal tax designation. And so if you are, so there are varying lobbying laws between state and federal, and you certainly want to be attentive to those. If you're a C3 or a C4, you're probably going to be a nonprofit corporation under state law. PACs sometimes are separate corporations. Sometimes they're kind of a separate fund within something else that has a separate I guess the easiest way to think of this is your EIN. If you have an EIN, you're separately taxable, as an entity for that. So the state laws may be more stringent than the federal, or vice versa. There's lobbyist registration requirements. And then when you think about the tax return, generally speaking, the way the tax returns work are that you file the federal 990 unless you're a church, or a church or auxiliary or something like that. And then with the AG's office or this on the state level, most of the time, if you engage in charitable solicitation, in many states you have to file with the state AG, which involves filing your 990, but there are a handful of jurisdictions that have no charitable solicitation, so you have no state requirements, and then all their requirements vary, and there's religious exemptions. It gets complicated very quickly. But the quick point from that is a good question, is definitely be attentive to federal and state requirements.
So one more question, and then some housekeeping. What is insubstantial lobbying? Is direct lobbying insubstantial? Does insubstantial lobbying always require filing a 501H election? Isn't Roe versus Wade unconstitutional? Oh, this is Supreme Court.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't realize
this is a great way to wrap up. You never know. Like, it's so fun to pray and think, Lord, where do you want to go with this talk? And then to hear what you guys have to say along those lines. This is the first part is like, oh, I wanted to cover that, but I just kind of moved on. So what is insubstantial lobby? I touched on it just briefly with the idea of money. Okay. So the way it works, generally speaking, is that it's both in terms of money and in terms of quality. So money is you're not allowed to spend, roughly speaking, more than 20% of your revenues on your annual expenses on lobbying. And it's 5% for grassroots and 15% for direct lobbying. And probably the easiest example of direct lobbying is you pay somebody to be a lobbyist, okay? So I had a client that said, we're going to hire this person, we're going to hire them to work 20 hours a week at X dollars, and we've got this much budget. So they actually did the numbers, and they said, okay, we're at 15%, and we're fine. Okay, when it comes to doing tweets and that kind of thing, like I said, unless it's like your staff overhead or whatever like that, you could send out 100 tweets. I've never tweeted, but anyway, or, you know, constant contact kind of stuff. It could be very quick. But what if you spend a lot of time preparing this article to go out on your news feed, but then you also use it for your educational newsletter? You know, where's the lobbying? That's grassroots lobbying. That's not. So you have to kind of, there's some numbers you have to crunch, and you want to stay below 20%. The percentage kind of changes a little bit depending on how much revenues you have, but that's the rough approximation. If you do a 501H election, it puts you into a quasi-safe harbor, which is basically the IRS saying, in exchange for you giving us a whole bunch of information, we'll probably just ding you for a tax, but not necessarily. So what do you do with that? It's a horrible gray area. So here I am. That's why generally I tell people, why do you want to self-report? Like, really? It's one more thing to file. Unless you have something like, okay, we're going to hire this lobbyist, we know where we're going to go, and this is going to be good. Because there's no guarantees. Even, like, if you get above the 20, maybe they'll ding you. Maybe, because the rule for 501c3 in the statute is you are exclusively, which pretty much means primarily, organized and operated for tax-exempt purposes, which is not lobbying. And the way that public policy tax theory is, the idea is that 501c3 is such a nice privilege that it comes with a cost. It comes with a cost that no other 501c category has to deal with. And so everybody else can do whatever they want, but 501c3 is not substantial. And it's up to the IRS to say what that is. And it's not, I think it's going to be more and more an issue because if it's not necessarily dollars. For example, this is particularly true. Like, if you're an up-and-running, wonderful organization that's been around a long time, you're going to probably be in better shape to deal with this than a baby organization that's just getting started. Because you're a big organization, here's your $3 million budget, you're going to spend $20,000 on lobbying. Well, that's insubstantial dollar-wise, and hopefully, as far as, like, what you do. Now, if all that the public sees you do is your lobbying, that's going to be a qualitative example. But you're a baby organization, and you say, well, we hope we get some money in. Here's our $20,000 campaign. What if you get $30,000 for the year? Okay, now it's super substantial. So it's a little bit like the boiling frog problem. You watch it, and that's why I talk about that hip pocket 501c4. At what point do we form a 501c4? The frog is starting to boil. So before we end this year, come mid-year, we have way too much money spent on lobbying, and we're a C3. What are we going to do? you're going to get a whole bunch more money in, and you're going to go, you know, make it proportional or move it out to a C4. Oh, and I'm sorry, let me just, I know we're real close here. The true meaning of nonprofit, it's like totally in the eye of the beholder. The key is excess revenues as opposed to profit. So, yes, Planned Parenthood is very profitable, and they get away with that. But the nonprofit is kind of a squishy legal term.
Please get familiar with your program book. For example, you'll find out if you look at the map in the program book where the prayer closet is. We have a place dedicated for prayer that you might want to stop at. Also, please visit all the exhibits if you do. For example, you can find out more about L'Arche Cleveland, whose executive director, April Boone, please raise your hand, April is here. There are many ways to be pro-life, right? And one is to take on the abortion issue directly. Another is to do what April does, which is to oversee an organization, a movement, a community that is providing a dignified life for adults with developmental disabilities. So that's what L'Arche Cleveland is all about, as well as all kinds of other great exhibits out there. Our next speaker is at 4 o'clock. And then finally, please give me or join me in giving a round of applause to our legal expert, who is not only so knowledgeable, but is also so faith-filled.